Some guys, some guys are only about that thing, that thing, that thing, that thing, that thing, that thing.
Coming to you from two corners of the world, it is That's the Thing, with your hosts, Alex and Nick. I'm Nick, and joining me today is, as always, Alex. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me here, Nick. It's great to be here.
We're both hosts of this program, but I guess I just wanted to ask how you're doing and what you're doing to keep yourself busy these days, cinematically speaking.
Thank you for asking. I mean, yeah, today is July 12th, 2020. I've just been trying to keep myself healthy and safe amidst the virus. In terms of cinema, I've been catching a few classic films that were written by screenwriter Frances Marion, including the Oscar winner The Champ, starring Wallace Beery and Jackie Cooper. And in honor of the late Ennio Morricone, I just recently saw a film that he composed for the first time, Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion.
Yeah, that one's a classic of Italian cinema, I know. What did you think of that one?
I really dug it. I thought it was really good. I enjoyed Morricone's music. I enjoyed the lead actor's performance. And I enjoyed how the film was the sort of a teeter and a bounce between realism and absurdist fantasy with a bit of black comedy about the power of authoritarianism. And it's absurd, but also quite chilling when you, even to today, 50 years after it first was released. And I think, and especially could raise discussion, especially with the power of and the abuse of police force in countries around the world, not just Italy.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, that is interesting that even though it's a universal theme, but it's also very much fondly remembered as being a specifically Italian classic as well.
Yeah, but I think that universality is the reason why I think it became such a huge hit all over the world and winning coveted prizes from like the Grand Prix at Cannes to the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. Because I think it was just one of those movies that people everywhere could respond to. Or, you know, bring their own personal feelings or connections to it.
Well, that sounds great. And that's on the Criterion Channel, yeah?
Yes, it is.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm going to have to check that. I mean, it's been on my to-watch list for several years. And, I mean, it's one of those movies I feel like I should have seen.
It's worth checking out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'll definitely check it out next time I get a little bit of a free time. I've just been mostly I'm kind of swamped with a bunch of side projects, actually, where I am watching a bunch of different things. But right now, actually, as a matter of fact, here at the NFTS, we're trying to organize a kind of a backyard outdoor screening season for some of the students, because some of the students have started coming back to class, and some of them will be working on site over the summer break. So the head of the school and he approached the programming curation department, asked if we could help out with kind of the selection of some summer films. And we've just been kind of watching, kind of looking through a bunch of submissions that other students from the school put forth and just sort of going through those and thinking about what would fit best with each other. And while also trying to have a fairly diverse selection of titles. And also we are wanting to take into consideration a particular subtopic of trying one subtopic that we're trying to kind of take into consideration is to focus on films that are by directors of color and that are focused on issues of or topics of social justice and racial equality given the current circumstances throughout the world. And so I mean, I've been watching a couple of movies. The other day I went, I didn't go anywhere. I just stayed here at home, but I went on Canopy, which is a great streaming source for anybody who has a library card. I recommend just signing up for it. It's free. You get to watch 10 titles per month for free. And they have a tremendous selection of international films, and I saw Elia Suleiman's 2002 movie Divine Intervention. I don't know if you're familiar with Elia Suleiman or his work.
Yes, I am familiar with his work. Like, he directed a film called It Must Be Heaven, right?
Yeah, it made its premiere at Cannes last year, and it made its round around the festival circuit. It was supposed to come out earlier this spring, but of course that didn't really happen, so it's just been kind of sitting around. But yeah, he's a Palestinian filmmaker. He's directed 4 feature films over the course of 20-plus years, and...
Who is this guy, Terrence Malick?
Well, actually, he's closer to Buster Keaton than he's Terrence Malick, in the sense that his, you know, he has a lot of, his films are maybe not strictly comedies, but they have a lot of comedic elements, and they do operate as silent comedies quite a bit of the time. So, for example, like this film, Divine Intervention, the opening scene, I'll just paint you a portrait. You just see this guy dressed as Santa Claus running through the underbrush, like on the outskirts of Nazareth, and he's being chased by 4 kids, and he's like leaking, like he's got like this bag full of presents, and presents keep falling out of the bag, and he just keeps throwing them at the kids as they're chasing him, and then they kind of corner him, and then he like falls over because he has a heart attack, and like that's the opening of the movie. But that's the thing, like the film is, it's operating as a semi, well, it is satirical, but it's not, again, a whole comedy. It's sort of a series of vignettes all circulating around kind of a few people living in a neighborhood. And one of them is an older man who has another man who has a heart attack, and he ends up in the hospital. And his son, who's played by Elia Suleiman, comes to visit him. And so that sounds like a pretty straightforward plot for a tearjerker. But again, like, there are set pieces and vignettes that can range from sort of the quotidian of every day, but with a touch of absurdity. Like there's, for example, a great scene involving a kid, you know, who's bouncing a soccer ball on his head and he's kicking it through this alleyway. And you see these 2 old guys kind of watching him from afar. And then finally he kicks the ball so high that it lands on the roof of another guy's apartment. And the guy comes out, he takes a knife out, and he stabs the ball, and he just throws it dead at the kid and leaves. But then you'll have like that. And then you'll have like, you know, some really surreal set pieces I won't spoil, but it all revolves around a question of Palestinian identity, which is, of course, is a major focus in Suleiman's career and his body of work. I mean, and it's interesting because, I mean, I've only seen It Must Be Heaven, but It Must Be Heaven is much more kind of about the question of being Palestinian outside of Palestine, within, you know, outside of Nazareth and that geographical region of the world. And whereas this is much more, it's still very much rooted firmly in that particular sense of place. And it is, it's an interesting film. It's curious and it's poignant, but it's funny and it moves at its own rhythm. And, you know, I think for a filmmaker whose work is generally pretty tricky to find in the West, I mean, for a number of reasons, but... since this one is fairly available on Canopy, I recommend, you know, if you're looking for a director who you might not have heard about very much, or, you know, whose work you might not have seen much of, Divine Intervention is a pretty good place to start.
Well, yeah, I'll definitely look into that. Thanks for the recommendation. Speaking of, you know, postponing releases, I thought this would be a good opportunity to segue into our main topic today, in which... because of the coronavirus, there's been one crucial element that's been missing this summer, and that is the summer movie season, which, as we know, has been essentially, you know, completely absent.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that it has and it hasn't, in that we don't have theatrical distribution or exhibition, but we do have films that are popping up on streaming services like Apple and Netflix, and it's, but you're right, it is this very strange in between place regarding the summer movie season, or lack thereof, thanks to the pandemic.
Yeah, and you know, I was then, it made me think about the evolution and history of the summer movie blockbuster and how it has changed over the years, and I think of what films constitute under that category.
Well, you know where the phrase or the term blockbuster comes from, don't you?
I do. It's it had a different meaning to begin with compared to the way that Blockbuster is used today.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because, I mean, there's a couple of different arguments for the etymology of that word. But, well, generally, historically, it's agreed upon that it first appeared in the early 1940s, around the time America entered the Second World War. And it referred to a form of bomb that was able to wipe out a city block, hence the term Blockbuster, which again seems somewhat inappropriate to use during wartime. But I mean, there you have it. And we have that theory, but then we also have the second theory, which is that it came from the practice of blockbooking, which is an obsolete practice that the studios were practicing really early on in like the 30s. Of what they would do is they would sell a package of films for a particular distributor to screen. You know, if a theater wanted to screen one major film from the studio would say, okay, but then you have to also screen all of these other films. And of course, now that practice has been discontinued, I mean, for a long, long time. But those seem to be kind of the origins of that word. And what's interesting is that we can see a lot of early progenitors for what you might call the summer blockbuster in the 40s and 50s. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I mean, even though before it became official, like it was actually used in some articles for films like The Robe was a film which a critic described as being a blockbuster.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. The Robe was considered. I forgot about that.
Yeah, it's like, and in also 1958, The Bridge on the River Kwai and Ten Commandments and The World in 80 Days, they were referred to as like the annually updated all-time BO champs list. And also in the late 40s, there was Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah, which was predicted to be a, quote, box office blockbuster.
Well, what's interesting, too, then... I know, I mean, maybe this is a little later than those films, but I think it's interesting to note that, you know, those films all were blockbusters in the sense that they were released. But like, well, when we talk about the summer blockbuster, I mean, that's a term that comes loaded with a lot of assumptions surrounding its making, its marketing, its connection towards either a brand name or a existing intellectual property more often than not. And definitely one of the earlier examples of that, I would argue, is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which we've talked about on this program before. But I mean, what's interesting is that it sort of was and it sort of wasn't a summer blockbuster because it did debut on, I believe, June 16th, 1960. And when it debuted in two New York City theaters. And of course, with the marketing, Hitchcock told the audience, you cannot come in after a certain period of time. And this extended to the press. Actually, there were no press screenings. He said to the press that if they wanted to see the film, they had to see it with the general audience. And the first review of the film was a day after its official release. And it came from Bosley Crowther, who in his Crowtherian, Crowther-esque way was not a champion of it, of course. At that point in his career, he was beginning to kind of lose relevancy in terms of his opinion. But I, you know, that's neither here nor there. What's interesting is that, you know, kind of the aura and mystique around the hype or buzz, if you will, both kind of phrases that weren't really within the popular lexicon like they are now. Those all fueled the eventual success of Psycho when it had a wider release later on in September, after the summer.
Well, yeah. And also other films I like to single out too, which I think kind of could be looked at as precursors to the contemporary summer blockbuster, what built up to it, were Bonnie and Clyde, Easy Rider, and American Graffiti. And what all those three movies had in common were their ability to appeal to younger viewers. And during a season which usually, for the summer, a lot of people would actually not prefer to go to movies because, you know, lack of air conditioning or so. Even Pauline Kael, the famous film critic, would actually take holidays off during the summer from her job.
I think that's, I don't know, there's something, you know, just hearing a critic taking the summer off, you know, now, again, it just speaks to, I think, how prevalent that is. That just sounds bonkers. Like, that sounds like career suicide.
Well, I think it would be after 1975, because we know everything changed with a little film called Jaws.
Yes, exactly. And we've talked a little bit about Jaws, and of course, 2 years later, a little indie. It was an indie in a lot of ways, but it wasn't. It was Star Wars. And again, like, you pinpointed something really key to this whole moment in history, Alex, which is that when these films, from Bonnie and Clyde up through Star Wars, so about 10 years, I mean, that's really kind of the span, essentially, of the new Hollywood, you know? And like you said, they were trying to court younger audiences because the vanguard was becoming less and less fashionable with the late 60s in terms of the Cultural Revolution. And after a series of flops, of course, you know, with Fox, the most famous example they had was Cleopatra, which just became so expensive, there was no way they were ever going to recoup their budget. But it is interesting that then, you know, with this desire for kind of a new cinema that was geared towards a younger, more hip, so to speak, audience, then we started to get, you know, within that cultural atmosphere, the ingredients necessary for bringing about Steven Spielberg's huge breakthrough. Because again, Spielberg had two movies before Jaws. By 1977, there was the arrival of this new mode of film going, or this new element of the film going experience, thanks to Star Wars, and to a lesser extent, you know, movies like Smokey and the Bandit, for example. Like, these kinds of movies that were fun, escapist, action. Well, and escapist really is the key term, because, again, by the late 70s, there was a huge sense of fatigue settling around. I mean, that's kind of the American mythical narrative, isn't it? That there was this fatigue settling around an American populace, tired of Watergate, tired of Vietnam, tired of political and social upheaval, looking for some semblance of either stability or an affirmation of something good happening.
Yeah, something a little more hopeful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Before we got Rambo living out this sort of living out this fantasy of reclaiming Vietnam that became really prevalent in the 80s, but you know.
Yeah, whether it be through Rambo, through Schwarzenegger, or even through Watchmen.
Well, that's the thing that Watchmen is skewering. You know, it's that wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
I mean, Watchmen is directly, like, you know, right in the middle of the 80s. It's kind of, I mean, that's what's brilliant about it, is that Alan Moore is looking at the cultural mood going on right now and saying, well, yeah, okay, I'm going to take it to its logical extreme of just having us win Vietnam, but it's thanks to a super god.
But to get back on the topic, you know, what I find interesting about with Jaws, you know, kind of being considered the first, like, summer blockbuster is that, you know, when we think about summer blockbusters, you know, there's this feeling like, that actually there's even a book written by Sheldon Hall and Steve Neal called Epic Spectacles and Blockbusters, A Hollywood History.
Oh yeah, good old Steve Neal. I've had to read quite a bit of him this past year.
And as they say, like, you know, blockbusters are usually referred to by the public as, quote, an unusually expensive production designed to earn unusually large amounts of money. And that is what we typically think of when we see, like, a major summer release. But what was interesting about Jaws was, even though that was a film that had a notorious production history and went way over budget for the studio, the final budget ended up costing a mere $12 million, which wasn't that terribly expensive. I mean, you alluded to Cleopatra, and to give reference, that was a film that cost $42 million, and that came out like a dozen years or so prior to Jaws.
Yeah, $40 million in 63 I'm not, I don't know exactly.
That was like the equivalent of around over $200 million.
But again, I'm like, and a part of me is going like, so that's like what a typical blockbuster costs now. But the market was different back then too. I mean, it was just not feasible to bank on movies that big.
No, not usually, no. I think Jaws also became, it became what it was as the first summer blockbuster because of that sort of thrilling escapist entertainment, but also it had a few, you know, because it had those other films to set up for it, you know, because to attract the youth populace, as I mentioned, like the ones I mentioned too, and also because of its brilliant marketing strategy, which was rather innovative for the time.
How so? How was it innovative?
Well, because back then, usually like most movies, the way they would be released back then is they would like release them like specifically in a couple theaters or so in like L.A. and New York, and then afterward, and they were run there for a while. Then maybe they would end their run there and then transfer them to another city or so where they play for a while, and then they hop over to another city, and so on and so forth until eventually played in second and third run theaters. But what Jaws did, and this is what's a common practice for today, is that had a more of a nationwide expansion, played in hundreds of theaters at once. I mean, now we have thousands of theaters to choose from, but back then, for like hundreds at that time, you know, that was new, that was innovative. Even though that was something that also was employed successfully by another major phenomenon that had a global impact, The Godfather.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think The Godfather, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think The Godfather definitely, it helped lay the groundwork for Jaws and Star Wars in a lot of ways. But it's something that we don't generally consider a summer blockbuster. You know, we kind of think of it more as a prestige picture.
And technically, The Godfather did not open in the summer, but still that marketing campaign of releasing it in like hundred, because the way The Godfather came out, initially like it did open like a few theaters in its first week, but then they like quickly played it in hundreds of theaters at once, which was, again, unusual and unheard of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. So then you have a couple of these major successes in terms of total nationwide expansion almost instantaneously, and that does give the industry a model of success to draw on. And they go, okay, let's keep this going. And then from that point on, we have, of course, Alien in 79 and a bunch of other movies coming out in subsequent years and decades. And the summer blockbuster season now generally it was... If I'm not mistaken, I mean, of course, this has been my perception in my lifetime, but it seems that it's gradually shifted somewhat, that the official commemoration of the summer blockbuster season was the beginning of May.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had like movies like Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, you know, opening the first weekend of May in 2002. And like that was the, you know, and then a year later, like the second X-Men movie opened the first weekend of May. But since then, it seems that there's been a gradual shifting as well now to incorporate movies in April.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of like some of the Fast... I mean, I can't remember all of when all of them opened, but I know some of the Fast and Furious movies opened in April. And that was sort of like a...
I know, there's a crap ton of those movies.
They're like the Land Before Time of movies about testosterone and muscle cars. But they're practically the same franchise. I mean, if you really break it down, I mean, that could be the subject of a whole other podcast, but how the Land Before Time and the Fast and the Furious franchise are really thematically simpatico. But as movies
They're both about family.
They're about family, man. But I digress. I think it's interesting that, like, you know, not the goalpost, but certainly the post of when this yearly tradition has started, you know, it's been pushed a little bit. And then, of course, there have been differences in terms of international marketing for summer films as well. We've seen gradually over time both a shifting of when the summer movie season starts and a source of the largest potential net profit for a lot of these major studios. And it doesn't seem like it's in the United States as much as it was, you know, when Jaws and Star Wars came out. And that makes sense, because with globalization and transnationalism, you know, there's been a gradual shift towards international markets.
Yeah, there has been. And I think that's sort of we would get some rare signs, a few signs where sometimes you'd see like a film do huge numbers worldwide, like Titanic. But then I think it was like after Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King made $1 billion worldwide. And then later throughout the mid-2000s or so, I think then people started seeing that from then on, like films getting bigger and bigger profits from the international market. Like films like Shrek 2 or Wedding Crashers and then eventually to superhero movies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I was going to say, you know, that we have this this sense of what you were just saying a minute ago, that, you know, when you were citing The Lord of the Rings and you know, that those were big hits, you know, international hits, and Titanic, but both Lord of the Rings and Titanic came out in December, and Titanic really kind of started that whole that kind of, in that way, it was sort of like setting the groundwork for, you know, testing the water, so to speak, no pun intended, ha ha ha, of a December release. And then Lord of the Rings capitalized on that. But still, with that all said and done, even though, you know, throughout the year now there's more kind of potential marketable dates or weekends. I mean, in fact, you know, the busiest weekend for the box office is the Christmas weekend. But that being said, there's still this sort of, there is this tradition that it's in certain countries, but I think especially we in America really love going to the movies on a hot July weekend, going to the inside of an air-conditioned building and engaging with one of the big blockbusters or franchise pieces. And I wonder why that is. Why do you think that is, that we really gravitate towards that still, almost a half a century later?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it comes down to what essentially I think is one of the primary reasons people always love going to the movies since the very beginning. It's that, and it's the term we keep using, which is as a means of escapism, you know, wanting to get some kind of entertainment, you know, and sometimes you need some kind of bombast, you know, or like high stakes adventure. Or sometimes maybe you just want something like a good comedy to make you laugh. Or, you know, just something that could even move you and to thrill you. I feel like, you know, there's just something kind of liberating and more free about doing that out in a nice summer day than like in a cold, frigid winter.
Well, that too. But there is still kind of that, you know, that holiday feeling when you go to the movies on Christmas Day. And, you know, you get to choose, like, I mean, there is that sort of model of programming and counter-programming of, like, I remember, for example, like, you know, when Django Unchained and Les Miserables came out the same day in 2012. And, you know, there's that whole feeling of, like, okay, like, the family that, you know, that's the family audience, predominantly more female-centric, skewed demographic, you know, that was marketed with Les Miserables. And a little more male, traditionally male, you know, counter-programming, wanting to see something that's not as, like, cozy or familial in that way, were drawn to Django Unchained. But do you think also that the summer movie season, that there's something, too, about, of course, because, you know, kids are out of school, and, you know, every day for them is a Saturday, so they can constantly go to the movies. I mean, that's what I did a lot, you know. I mean, you can attest to that, too. I mean, you grew up with me. I remember when we were, you know, in the golden days of summer, you know, we were, you know, you'd go to a cinema and you'd say, oh, what's playing? And you'd have one marquee Minority Report, the next Lilo and Stitch, the third Juana Man. And there'd be like one guy in line for Juana Man.
Sadly, we did not follow that guy's lead with Juana Man. But
I hope, I really do hope that I run into that man someday. I mean, I don't know if I would recognize him because, I mean, you know, this is a long, this is ancient history by this point now. But like, if I ever recognized that man, I would just like want to go up to him and be like, so was that movie any good?
I guess we'd have to find out ourselves eventually. But yeah, like you said, I mean, you mentioned the counter-programming in Christmas, but also, yeah, with, like, considering Minority Report and Lilo and Stitch opened the same weekend, no less, you know, that's also another excellent case of counter-programming. And I think there is that variety, too, for counter-programming, because even though we tend to think of, again, the summer blockbuster as, you know, having a lot of explosion and noises, bells and whistles, but there's also some there are also some huge hits that have come out over the years that people then would also go see, you know, and you get word of mouth on, whether it's like Oscar winners like Forrest Gump, which was a huge phenomenon, or even if it's like indie sleeper hits like The Blair Witch Project and The Sixth Sense of 99, or My Big Fat Greek Wedding of 02.
Yeah, My Big Fat Greek Wedding is such an interesting case study, because that is one of those movies that it really did feel like it, because it premiered at Sundance, right?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
Yeah, so that's one of those movies that, and that's the kind of, I mean, that is the quintessential summer sleeper hit, because it comes out, it opens and, you know, limited release, and it has a slow expansion. You know, it's like, it is like, in a lot of ways, it's sort of the antithesis of the blockbuster model, where it just slowly rolls out across the nation, and it just, you know, it opens to decent numbers, not spectacular, nothing record-breaking, and it just stays in the top 10 for nearly the entire summer through its June release date. And that is one of those things that, like, the longer it stays, the more audiences go, oh, have you heard of this movie? Have you, well, you've got it. Like, you know, it is what we, you know, what people would call something that you talk about at the water cooler. Like one of those things that, one of those discoveries that you would, you know, say, oh, well, have you seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding? Oh, well, you're missing out. Like you've got to see it. And then that prompts this urge to partake in a communal discourse around a particular thing of like, that's sort of seizing the national imagination or the cultural imagination in that way.
Yeah, and that was definitely the case, I think, for Blair Witch Project, because that was a film that premiered at Sundance, and then you got the word of mouth, and you had also, again, to it, which I think is a component I feel like plays a crucial role in the kinds of summer programming we get, and that's effective marketing campaigns. It had such an innovative marketing campaign, because I believe it was also, yeah, like with its website and also its mockumentary talking about the lore behind the Blair Witch, and it piqued audiences' interest and curiosity, and then everybody was talking about it to the point where we even got a Scooby-Doo parody.
God, I remember watching that, you know, when it first aired back in 99 and still being slightly creeped out by that.
Yeah, I remember that too, finding it a little creepy, but I watched it again last Halloween with a friend, and we still kind of found it funny, especially the part when Scrappy Doo appears, like people, they hear his voice, Uncle Scooby, shh, do you hear that? That's Scrappy, he found us. And then they see him, ah, hi gang.
Now that's terrifying. Yeah, well, I think you've also hit the nail on the head, and I mean, in a lot of respects of why the Blair Witch Project was such a big success. I mean, well, because the marketing helped generate this mystique and this sense of the world around the film, and also because it to a less lascivious or lurid degree, it is sort of like what happened with Cannibal Holocaust, you know, where there was a brief moment in the national conversation where like people were asking each other, well, it's not real, right? No, it's is it? And you know, there's that brief moment where there was this uncertainty of like, is it a documentary? Is it all fiction? I mean, how much of it is real? And that only just, again, I mean, that was so genius about the marketing of that movie. And because the film was really capitalizing off of what was then still a relatively new platform for marketing. I mean, you know, you had certain movies, like, I mean, you can still, if you still are interested, you can still find the official website for the movie Space Jam on the internet.
Wow.
It's so great. It's so, so primitive, but like, I mean, The Blair Witch was not the first movie to have a presence, a marketing presence on the internet, but it was one of the first movies to really take advantage of the internet as a marketing tool, as, you know, for instigating discussions amongst message boards. And I mean, that's the thing too, like, you know, with message boards, I mean, that's a whole other way of engaging with the film, vis-a-vis geek culture or fandom culture, which I think in itself also is sort of, fan culture in America sort of, it's almost congruent with the inception of the summer blockbuster season, wouldn't you agree?
Oh yeah, like especially that was how that was a key factor to the success of Star Wars, that because the Fox itself wasn't really investing a lot of money in the marketing, so Lucasfilm did itself, and it did things like talk about the movie at the San Diego Comic-Con and really reach out to people in the science fiction fandom. And those are the people that then it really got their interest when they heard about it like a year in advance through things like a Marvel Comics adaptation and a novelization written by George Lucas himself. So yeah, I agree with you. And I also want to talk about with marketing campaign, because we say how, you said how Blair Witch wasn't the first to use the internet, but it still used it in an innovative way. It's like kind of like how Jaws wasn't the first film to have like a lot of money put in a television advertisement campaign, but it was, that honor goes to a Charles Bronson film called Breakout, which if you've never heard of it, well, that's because it wasn't a hit. So, but this movie, I think it was a combination of factors of this TV campaign and with the, coming off of a popular book, and then you just keep hearing about it everywhere. So then that just got people's interest to go see it. So it really is a combination of factors, so that I think with that advertising, whether it's in television or internet, I think especially if you have an intriguing premise and if you know your fan base, I think it's there's the potential for this crossover appeal, like with those two movies, which kind of changed the way that of what kinds of movies were being made and presented to the market.
I mean, I think it's interesting that you've pinpointed an example of a film that is primarily engaging with what should be a formula for success, as Jaws proved, and it wasn't a success. And I think, you know, what's fascinating to me is that over the course of its, you know, of the modern summer movie season, we've had just as many instances of movies that exploit sort of certain formulas towards great success and others that seemingly try to capitalize off of that and they just fail miserably. I mean, yeah, the most famous, well, one of the most famous examples I can think of right now is, The Adventures of Pluto Nash.
Oh God, yeah.
You know, I mean, this is when Eddie Murphy was still like, this is 2002 and this was like Eddie Murphy was still pretty big. I mean, he was coming off of Shrek, which was a huge hit, and you know, he had still like a lot of goodwill, enough goodwill, I think, from the first two Nutty Professor movies. I mean, even though they're not great movies, but like they were hits and, you know, people liked them. So, I mean, it was this feeling that like, oh yeah, we'll make a big budget sci-fi comedy with Eddie Murphy and Randy Quaid. And that movie it was just an abysmal failure all around. I mean, it is one of those movies I haven't seen it in the better part of a decade. I just remember it is very bad.
Oh, but, yeah, it is.
I mean, what's interesting about the movie now, people don't really talk about the movie as much as just how it was this, and how culturally irrelevant it was. And because it was so irrelevant, that in a way reinstates it some element of relevance just because of its failure, if that makes any sense. It's like the Robot Chicken sketch.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it essentially became a comedic punchline with that Robot Chicken sketch of Pluto Nash Day. Which is, if you haven't seen it, and if you like dark comedy, you'll love this one.
And it also gives you a perfect idea of I mean, for a movie that, again, I think with every passing year becomes more and more obscure, it gives you an idea of, like, what one of the major flops of that era was. And again, gauging like just how badly it failed, because it should have worked on paper with a big star and in his comfort zone. And But I mean,
and it was from the director of City Slickers, you know, a comedy classic.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, and so yeah, it is interesting to me that when there are films that over the summer season, they try to kind of either for some reason, one way or another, they kind of try to either conform to the formula or they sort of fall to the wayside, and then they kind of sit on the shelf, they gather some dust, but then they don't become successes in the moment. They sort of become successful after the fact as sort of cult classics, you know, and then they're really, you know, they're really revered.
Yeah, I mean, one of the I think the biggest title I can think of, which is a film that was a flop and but has been a cult classic, but again, it was kind of like the Cleopatra of its time, was Kevin Costner's Waterworld.
Oh yeah, I just had a conversation with some people about Waterworld the other day.
I mean, that's the thing. That's the kind of movie that you know, it was at the time, it was the most expensive film ever made. So kind of like Cleopatra, there was sense like, even though it opened at number one at the box office, there was like no way this movie was going to recoup its budget. And it didn't. But it still had a life on home video, and it's highly revered to the point that there's even a special edition Blu-ray edition that has like a few different versions of the film.
Oh yeah, Arrow's special edition of the film is it is the most obscenely stacked special edition for that movie you will ever find. And it is, I can guarantee, from me to you, listener, the best gift to give to your family member who loves that movie, so they will never, ever, ever have to buy another copy of that fucking movie ever again.
Yeah, that's the thing, because, like, it's, yeah, there's a special fondness for that movie from, I think, a generation of people who probably grew up watching it. And I know, because I remember when we went to Universal Studios a couple of years ago, and the first thing we saw was a Water World water show. And this family member that we spoke of was like instantly like, let's go to that.
Yeah, I think I remember them saying like the first thing we did when we got through the gates was, okay, guys, we're going to go see the Water World show. And we're like, oh, really? And they were like, yes.
And no, it was fun in its corny way. But that's the thing. That's the power. Sometimes that's the power of legacy in an afterlife, even if it's not considered a commercial success in its initial run.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a similar thing too with like, I mean, to a similar degree, but to a somewhat different degree too, then, you know, you have a movie like, yeah, like Big Trouble in Little China, which came out, I mean, that's one of those movies that came out like in August of 86, if I remember correctly. 86 was the year. And you know, it comes out in the dog days of summer, and you can clearly tell why it came out in the dog days of summer, because you know, in August, that's kind of after a lot of the major tent poles have premiered, and you kind of get these, you know, sometimes you do get certain films that a studio releases and it becomes a big hit. And then other times, or like, you know, a studio's banking on a particular tent pole title. Like,
well, actually it came out during the 4th of July week.
It did?
Yes, it did.
Oh, so I take back everything I just said.
Yeah, but Pluto Nash was the August dud.
You're right. Pluto Nash is a great example of the August dud, of where a studio doesn't quite know how to market it, and they just decide, you know what, let it go. Just let it out into the ether and see what we can do with it. Whereas, to me, I think it's so interesting that Big Trouble in Little China was released over the 4th of July weekend. Because who in there, I mean, you've got to think that the studio, and I'm pretty sure the studio, when they saw, you know, what John Carpenter had whipped up for them, they thought to themselves, well, what can we do with this? You know, I mean, Big Trouble in Little China is one of the strangest summer movies ever made, as far as I'm concerned, in that it on paper, it hits all of the right notes and it should be like a crowd pleasing blockbuster. And yet it is such an unapologetically outre film that it is inescapably a cult film.
And also, it didn't help the film, at the time of its release, it didn't help that it came out like 16 days before Aliens.
Oh, that too. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of what happened with Don Bluth as well, wasn't it? When he had Secret of Nim come out, and then that was like, what, right before or after E.T.?
Well, I know it was during the year, like, that year, like, almost every family film was swamped by E.T., you know, because, like, no matter how soon it was before or after E.T. came out, people still went to go see E.T.
I mean, that is kind of interesting, you know, when you have a film that is so dominant within the cultural conversation that everything else gets eclipsed from that summer.
It's kind of, for me, it's more like more of a comparison I think of is, it's like when The Dark Knight came out 1 week after Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. You know, and Hellboy 2 is a great superhero sequel, but then, like, Dark Knight, like, everybody was talking about that movie, and sadly, Hellboy 2 suffered for it, you know, which I blame totally on the studio.
Well, exactly. I mean, to me, that is very much the fault of the studio thinking that, oh, we can just... Well, and it also important to note that Hellboy 2 came out a week after Hancock, the Will Smith movie, which, does anybody remember Hancock? You're a Peter Berg fan, or you're one of those people who's like, oh yeah, I saw that in a Blockbuster once, and I, you know, rented it one night just on a kick, and it was okay, you know? But, like, that movie was a hit, you know, because Will Smith was, for a moment there, one of the most bankable stars. Like, it's not that he's not bankable, he's just not in a lot of things, and when he is in some things, it's just not great. But, I mean, you know, we're not going to trash Will Smith on this program. But I'm just, you know, just all that to say that you have one of the world's biggest movie stars, and then you have this highly anticipated sequel, you know, and then that's sort of, and that is also the consequence of the model of marketing major blockbusters that's become sort of the de facto norm, particularly in relation towards Disney, because Disney's monopolizing the market by buying up nearly everything. But it doesn't leave room for, like, you can have only a certain amount. Well, and of course, this is all accompanied as well by rising ticket prices. I mean, ticket prices have steadily increased further and further over the last 40 plus years since Jaws came out. And in that respect, the average moviegoer has to be more discerning about what film they're going to go see. So more often than not, they're going to save their money to go see the new Batman movie. You know, because that's the movie everybody's going to be talking about, you know, and that in itself, I think, is an unfortunate side effect of that communal excitement, you know, the water cooler effect, you know, of when you feel the compulsion that you have to see something because everybody else is seeing it, but then you lose sight of everything else that's around there.
Well, I think it's a side effect of, as you put it, like when it's a combination of a competitive market and when you have like higher prices, so then it becomes less affordable to see more stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but then again, you know, do not underestimate the power of counter-programming, because, I mean, that still is effective. You know, we had, actually, in terms of the Dog Days of Summer with August, I think, you know, a great recent example that comes to mind is 2 years ago when we had Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that movie was an enormous success, you know. But that's also the example of a Dog Days of Summer movie that, you know, it's counter-programming, it's a romantic comedy, and it does well with a domestic audience. But then internationally, it also does very well. So then it's a movie that the studio doesn't invest a lot of money in, really. And it just becomes an enormous hit.
Well, you know, it's interesting because now I think about, because we talk about counter-programming and with which titles people might be interested in seeing. And I, you know, it makes me think because of how this summer, even though the movie theaters are looking to reopen soon, even though we're still deep in the midst of this virus and it's not going well for the United States... And I know it's not going well for the United Kingdom either. Am I correct in assuming that?
Well, I mean, I will say comparatively speaking, the numbers in the United Kingdom are dropping a little bit. But of course, you know, a couple of weekends ago, I want to say it was a couple. I mean, you know, telling time when you're in quarantine is difficult. But fairly recently, we had, you know, a bunch of people go to the beach near Leicester or go to the beach, and then there was a huge, you know. Surge of cases in Leicester, and on July the 4th, actually, which the Brits called Super Saturday, To me, there's such a great irony in the British celebrating the 4th of July. But I mean, but essentially, you know, they reopened the pubs and they reopened some of the cinemas. I mean, not all. There's still a lot of cinemas in London, I know, for example, that haven't reopened. And but there's, of course, no social distancing being observed at any of the pubs that I haven't passed by many pubs, but any of the pictures that you see in some news stories, there's not really any social distancing. So, I mean, frankly, I don't really have much. I'm not staking much hope in a stable market right now for cinemas to reopen and for the summer movie season to come back. And I think actually, you know, even if Britain were doing better than it is right now, it still wouldn't happen because I think the States, you know, is in such dire straits that it wouldn't make sense for the studios to open their movies, you know, unless you completely forego the United States as a market. And that in itself would be pretty damning.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, I don't see that happening right now, you know, especially because these are American studios and they know that these movies will get leaked. Like if they release Tenet in several countries, like that movie's going to get leaked and people are going to see it. And then they'll like lose quite a bit of money anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because yeah, films like Tenet and Mulan, like their releases were postponed because of the virus. Initially, they were going to then come out in July, but now they've been postponed again to like late August. Mm-hmm. But I'm not even sure if they'll make those release dates. But yeah, at this point, currently in the country, not a lot of movie theaters are open. Only like a couple of local independent cinemas, like here in Minnesota, the Heights and the Tryland Cinema are opened, albeit to limited capacity. And of course, you have drive-ins open. But it makes me think about now how, aside from those, like if people want to catch some new releases, they're more likely to find them at home through like streaming services. And there have even been some movies which were going to get a theatrical release, but then opted for streaming instead because of the virus. Like the Tom Hanks World War II thriller Greyhound was going to be released by Sony Pictures, but now is being streamed currently on Apple TV Plus.
Right. I mean, well, that makes sense in a way that, they would try to recoup their losses in some other way. And with a movie like that, that's not, you know, when I hear a title like that, you know, and I see like, you know, still images of Tom Hanks in that, I get flashbacks to Catherine Bigelow's K-19, The Widowmaker. And I think to myself, this probably isn't going to do, you know, gangbuster business at the box office, but it'll be fine to watch at home. So, and I do think like some of these companies or these studios are thinking, you know what, let's, you know, get this released anyway. And, you know, it's Tom Hanks. People will see him. They love him. He is the celebrity poster child of this pandemic. So, I mean, he still has a lot of goodwill from the majority of sensible people in the world. But, yeah, I think it's interesting, though, to also think about the impact this has had on more auteur-driven movies that were set to come out in the summer, or that did come out in the summer. But, you know, like Wes Anderson's new movie, The French Dispatch, was going to premiere. It did technically premiere at Cannes, but it was like the Cannes that was an international market for industry insiders. So like that doesn't really count. And, you know, it's not the same thing. And it didn't get a theatrical release in the summer. It's going to be released later in the fall. And then you have like Spike Lee's new movie, which did get released on Netflix. It was always planned to be released in the middle of June. And it did get released. And because of the lack of films that are out there right now, I mean, both auteur-centric or otherwise, then there seems to be like even more of a focus on a movie like The Five Bloods, where you're like, oh, thank God, like there's, you know, something that we can actually like gravitate towards and like something to like to start generating some conversation for. And, you know, whether or not you loved the movie, like at least it's, you know, it that in itself feels like, you know, a classic example of summer counter-programming.
And also to counter-program that, I was going to say something to counter-program that, it would be like, you know, you can watch either something that's some adult feature like The Five Bloods, or watch more silly comedy like Eurovision Song Contest with Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams.
Exactly. And that's all Netflix, you know. I think Netflix is trying to kind of... And that's the thing. I think Netflix, in a way, is going to come out of this pretty all... I mean, Netflix and Disney, because Disney has Disney Plus, and, you know, they've got so much money that they're going to be just fine. But Netflix is really taking advantage of the current moment in terms of offering some substitute for movies that otherwise aren't really out there. I mean, other than the Tom Hanks title that you mentioned, I mean, I'm having a hard time thinking about films right now. I mean, I know there have been some indie films that have kind of played in limited release and that aren't streaming, they've also kind of fallen to the wayside.
I mean, and maybe you can, if you search out, maybe if you go to a site like for me, Minneapolis Film Society or Riverview or Parkway, if you go on those sites, maybe you can find some more obscure titles through there. Otherwise, if you're looking for bigger budget features, you're right. I think a lot of them have been postponed because the studios don't want to lose a lot of money by not having them released. With the exception being maybe if they're kind of like, well, we know there's no way this is going to make a... it's not going to be a hit, like with Disney Plus releasing Artemis Fowl, you know, which was going to be given a theatrical release, but then finally was put to Disney Plus with the vitriolic critical reception.
Poor Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, but I want to ask, once the pandemic ends, do you think that there will still be people who will go to the movies during the summer, like go out to the movie theaters? Or do you think there is a chance that time is over?
Well, I mean, I think it's a complicated question, or at least it elicits a complicated answer because, well, for a number of reasons. A, it all depends on when a vaccine is found and when that's made available, and that will really provide a greater sense of security for people to go back out to the movies. Until that happens, I mean, we don't know when that's going to be the case. I mean, I do think that there will be some trepidation going back out into the cinema, but I think at the same time, I think people will also really gravitate towards that because, you know, people for the last 4 months have been consuming the majority of their media content through their computer screen. And that gets a little tiring after a while. I mean, as somebody who spends several hours of the day looking at my computer screen, either in Zoom meetings or working or watching stuff, it definitely takes a toll on your attention span. And I mean, I do think that there will be people who are, once it's safe to go back out to the movies, will relish that opportunity of being in a communal setting, of watching a film on the big screen with a really great surround sound system, with air conditioning, with concessions. I mean, you can make popcorn at home as well, but there's nothing like the vicarious joy of smuggling in a Snickers bar, you know, to a movie. that in itself is also a part of the long-worn tradition of sneaking snacks into the movie. But I don't think that it's going to end. I don't think it will, because I think people, we're creatures of habit and we like the familiar. And it's become so familiar in that way. And I mean, thankfully familiar in the sense that it's not hurting anybody, that people will go back to it. Now, do I think that this will impact the way studios release their films? That's an entirely different question. And I do think, I think in a way there will be more of a focus on streaming platforms to, I mean, there already has been in the last decade with the rise of Netflix and Hulu and any number of streaming sources in the world. There's been a rise in people predominantly watching their content on streaming platforms. But I think this will, in a way, it will prompt studios to think about a contingency plan, you know, of investing in media property, in content that is a reasonable investment that they can help kind of recoup their budget in. Because nobody's making any money people are losing money right now. And I think, you know, fingers crossed, if next summer we're able to all go back to the cinema safely, the studios are going to have to do a lot to recoup the money they've lost.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with everything you said. And for me, myself, I, as a film goer, would love to go back to the movie theater when it's safe to go back, because I still think, and I feel there are other people who feel this way too, where there's something valuable in seeing a movie in a cinema on a big screen that whose effect you can't quite replicate on home video, or certainly not on your computer. And, you know, there are movies that, I think there are lots of movies that you can just skip at the cinema and just wait till they come to DVD or so. But then
DVD, what's that?
Yes. I'm a bit old, Sonny. But but then there are movies like Tenet is a film I would love to see on the big screen, because Christopher Nolan is the kind of director whose films demand to be seen on the biggest screen possible. And that's something that you don't usually get
right
from a lot of filmmakers nowadays. So I think you're right. There is going to be a contingency plan. And who knows? Maybe the marketing will go back to like the days of pre-Jaws, where maybe, and pre-Godfather, where maybe they'll release even big blockbusters like in a few theaters and then disperse them to another spot, you know, to save on theater costs. And maybe they'll also limit on television advertising costs. I mean, who knows? So what could happen?
Who knows? I mean, they're going to have to cut corners somewhere. I mean, I have a hard time imagining a studio is going to be rolling out a major blockbuster very slowly, because again, there's the risk of piracy. And, you know, if it's especially like a big title, Disney's not going to roll out another Avengers movie city by city. They're going to release that bad boy all over the country all at once.
Yeah, you're right. Piracy, that's the one key difference between the early golden age of Hollywood and now.
I mean, no one was taking a 16, like a Super 8 millimeter camera into Psycho and filming it and distributing the reels outside of the cinema going, hey, do you want to see what happens in this movie?
I mean, now I'm just imagining, because I think about also other movies that had effective advertising campaigns and were like more spread wide. Like I think of Independence Day. I wonder how many people like videotaped the movie in the theater or so.
Yeah. That's an interesting one to bring up, Independence Day. That's a kind of movie that's, it's sort of a classic too, but it's one of those classics that is more, it carved out its own stamp on pop culture because of the way it was marketed and because of the way it, well, I mean, its special effects were great for the time, and it also made Will Smith a star. But
and also because it's like that kind of disaster movie formula that you see then emulated a lot in films like The Day After Tomorrow or even the Transformers movies. I mean, I think somebody once described Independence Day as like being an okay movie with an innovative, excellent marketing campaign.
Well, you know what it is, I think. I mean, it's also, I mean, what's interesting is that, and now we're kind of getting into really unpacking some weird cultural trauma here. But my theory is that Independence Day, it somehow struck a chord with so many Americans. What to me, it's so interesting that it struck a chord primarily with American audiences in a pre-9/11 environment of, we have a movie where an external, literally alien threat decimates national landmarks and markers of our civilization. And then that sort of threat brings people together. There's something about the kind of, again, like that tribal almost feeling of defending us against them, you know, that I think, yeah, you know, that makes Independence Day almost primarily resonant in a way. I mean, of course, it's, I think, more polished than some more jingoistic examples of that similar ideological thread. But I do think that is why a movie like Independence Day was such a massive hit, is because it taps into that shared cultural fear of our loss of a way of life. And that, in a way, has only just become more and more prevalent for a lot of Americans for a lot of different reasons. And I think that makes it, in a lot of ways, I don't think it makes it a great movie, and not even really a good movie, but I do think it makes it a distinct movie in the realm of blockbusters. And as a film, as you said, like it ushered in kind of the Michael Bay spectacles of Armageddon, and the Transformers films, and it did take the sort of the Altman-esque ensemble piece and planted it within a disaster. I mean, there were disasters.
It's more like the Towering Inferno or the Poseidon Adventure.
That's exactly what I was going to say. But what it does with that is, I mean, of course, it has more special effects. It has a grander scope, but it's still operating on kind of that sort of primal level in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, I find it's interesting. At the end of the day, it's interesting because you could apply this to any season of the year, but I think with summer too, there are movies that I think a lot of the films that stand out, whether they, and you know, still speak to people, whether they are huge successes upon release or whether they find a life afterwards, I think it's if they speak to a culture, you know, so in a such a visceral way, whether it's like, and like you said, whether like Independence Day, that sense of unity against a foreign and literal alien threat that threatens to destroy their way of life, or which I think is kind of similar to what the original Star Wars did as well, which was like a group of people defying against a fascist authority, against the man.
But that's why that movie resonated within the 1970s of like, you have an establishment which is already corrupt or morally questionable, and then you have primarily a young rebellion fighting against them. And that resonates, you know, within the popular imagination. Just like Independence Day, I think Independence Day is interesting too because it's a post-Cold War blockbuster, you know, but it's a pre-9/11 blockbuster, you know. So what's the great threat, you know? You know, it doesn't really matter. It's aliens, you know, it's not the Russians, it's not anything else, you know, but the important thing is that, you know, there's always this threat posed towards American sovereignty, towards American ideals, and we'll band together and win the day somehow. I mean, maybe that's my read. Maybe I'm just being a little cynical about Independence Day, but I do think that that's...
Well, no, I think you're onto something. I mean, even considering... I'm curious to hear what some of your English friends think of the depiction of the English in that movie. Like, that part when they're
all
like...
All 3 seconds of them?
Yeah, like, it's the Americans. They say they have a plan to counterattack the aliens. About bloody time.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Like, that's the other thing, too. Like, the writing of any other country in the world in that movie is so fucking basic. With the British, we gotta have them say the word bloody once. Some African country somewhere, oh, they're like, you know, running outside waving spears or whatever. Like, it's so neo-colonialist in that respect. But we could get into a whole episode talking about Roland Emmerich and his whole problematic engagement with representational politics, but that's for another day. What I wanted to ask you, I think, is just, do you have, now this could be either a movie or a marketing campaign for a summer movie that has stuck with you, or something that you really, really enjoyed, you know, that maybe wasn't like a big hit or didn't really quite catch on when it was first released?
You know, that's a great question and difficult to answer because there are so many. I guess I have to go with Juana Man. Kidding. But seriously, in terms of like, well, when I think of a movie, when you say marketing campaigns, like that really I found effective, you know, and maybe it's because I was 10 years old at the time, so it really left an impression, but it was the marketing for Lilo and Stitch, which I thought was kind of genius. Because the way that movie was promoted, it was like them saying, okay, it's a 2D Disney animated feature, but this is something different. It's got some edge to it. It's kind of a different animal from what we've seen before. And I love especially the way they insert that character, Stitch, into those films of the Disney Renaissance to show, yeah, this is how different it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was very much cognizant of Disney's waning popularity after the heyday of the Renaissance and trying to think, like, okay, what can we do to make ourselves seem relevant in the 21st century, you know, pretty early on in the 21st century. And they had, yeah, this way to try and kind of coast off of the success of Shrek in presenting something that was edgier than ultimately Lilo and Stitch really is. I mean, Lilo and Stitch is still a pretty unusual Disney film, but it's, you know, it's not quite as subversive as Shrek, but nevertheless, it still was done in a way that was, it seemed fresh and inventive. And you're right, it was unusual. And you were thinking like, and it was very much kind of not even focused on the story. It's like this character, this figure, Stitch. And you're thinking like, well, what the hell is this thing? Like, I mean, it's like that great Daily Show sketch where one, I can't remember which correspondent it was, who was just like listing all these, like when they announced Princess and the Frog, and he was like, well, finally, we have a black Disney princess, you know, after years of having a redhead princess, a brunette princess, an Indian princess, and whatever the hell Stitch is.
Yeah, I remember that.
And, I mean, I do think, yeah, that played a part in making the film appealing and ultimately a hit.
What about you? Was there, like, a summer movie that was overlooked, or its marketing campaign stood out to you?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not the movie itself, as much as just sort of, this is just one instance of marketing that I really love because it just comes out of nowhere. And to me, it's one of those things too, where you have to wonder to yourself, like, who in their right mind thought that this would end up really working, but it still makes me laugh, is actually a few weeks after Lilo and Stitch came out with the Powerpuff Girls movie. And the way that, like, I think, you know, the it's the commercial that Adult Swim did where Space Ghost is promoting the movie. And it's just one of those, it's like a 30-second spot. And it just, you know, it's done at that irreverent Space Ghost style where it doesn't really talk about the movie. And yet it does actually tell you what the movie's about. So that's effective. But then at the same time, it has all of these weird non sequiturs. And in terms of, giving you even the wrong release date, that it's just by the time you watch it, you kind of wonder to yourself, like, okay, like, you know, you have enough goodwill from Space Ghost that you kind of almost feel somewhat motivated to, like, maybe check this movie out, you know. And even though the Powerpuff Girls movie was a piece of crap, like, that commercial, I think, is still, it's still the best thing to have come out of that movie.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to feel. Like, on one hand, I'm thankful that the film tanked at the box office because, yeah, it is awful. But on the other hand, I feel bad because it's like, maybe it's a sign that the commercial wasn't effective enough, but I do love that spot, you know. It's almost one of those ads where, for me, it's like, I wish they could have put that kind of ad for a better movie.
It's kind of like, you know, when... I mean, I love the whole thing that they did with Ghostbusters, where they had like a little hotline that I think it was Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd were just answering the phone like over a weekend, and there were like 1,000 people calling in. Like, to me, that's genius.
Yeah, that is genius. That's brilliant.
That sort of that paratextual engagement with the audience. And I think that is kind of, I mean, that's the example like that we've kind of cited with all of these things. Like, it's sort of related to the story of the film, but I think the key to a great bit of marketing, especially for a summer movie, is to sort of generate some sort of conversation around the film, almost, so that people kind of talk about the film so much that they kind of forget to ask the basic question of, well, what's the story? I mean, if you can talk about the story as well, then all the, like, you know, with a movie like Inception, that's all the better. But I think with a lot of marketing, it's not like it's outright lying, but it is very much trying to think about, okay, like, what can we do to kind of generate this aura around the film that we're trying to put out to the public, so that to convince them, like, oh, this seems unusual. I might want to check this out.
Yeah, you give an interesting hook or angle to sell to the public that makes it distinct, and to therefore make the audience curious and go, okay, like, if I'm going to spend my money, you know, my $8 or so, maybe this one's worth spending on it, you know, because at least maybe I'll get something different.
Yeah, exactly. See, that's the reason why Pluto Nash was such a flop. They just didn't have, it was actually a reason
one
why they
Space
flopped,
Ghost
they
commercial.
Had, who knows? History might have, the course of history may very well have taken a different trajectory. You know, it'll be a while before we come back to the summer movie season, but at least, you know, we've waxed poetic on summer's past, and, you know, I look forward to the day that we can spend time together in the cinema watching a, maybe not a great movie, but an enjoyable movie together.
Yes, as am I, you know, and, you know, hopefully this will be a good opportunity. A way I look at this on a bright side, too, is that, you know, with drive-ins open, there's some which have some, like, indie films playing there, and then others that are having, like, former releases playing there, too. But I think it could serve as a good excuse for people to, like, drive out, to go drive out and to see some movie, some, like, beloved classics or so. Like, this weekend, for instance, as I'm recording right now, there's a drive-in that's playing a double feature of Inside Out and The Empire Strikes Back. So, you know, be if you want to see some good, like, classic entertainment, you know, for the summer, there you go.
Well, actually, I don't know if you heard the news, but the number one movie in America this past weekend was, in fact, The Empire Strikes Back.
Nice.
I mean... That's the kind of, I mean, we're living in 1980 all over again. Yay. Well, Alex, it's always a pleasure talking with you. I hope that you continue watching great movies, and I can't wait for us to meet up again and talk a little more. But in the meantime, take care of yourself, and to everybody out there listening, I hope you stay safe, stay healthy, stay happy, and continue watching great movies. Take care.
Take care, everyone. We're all in this together.
Greetings, I'm Space Ghost. I'm here to talk to you about the fantastic new Powerful Girls movie. I haven't seen it yet, but you will, because it has monkeys, I think. Maybe it doesn't have monkeys, but it should. I know it has Powderpuff Girls in it. They're personal friends of mine. Or are they? Find out this Christmas.
The Powerpuff Girls movie, only in theaters July 3rd, rated PG.